From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, City Streets and City Politics, we talk with Steve Lopez, a popular columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He often writes about neighborhoods. His first novel, Third in Indiana, is set in a North Philadelphia neighborhood that's been taken over by drug dealers. Also, Quentin Tarantino's new film Pulp Fiction may have revived or initiated your interest in surf music. Pulp Fiction's opening credit sequence features a recording of Miserloo by the king of surf guitar, Dick Dale. We'll feature a 1993 interview with Dick Dale. And Stephen Schiff takes a look at Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the new film directed by Kenneth Branagh, starring Branagh and Robert De Niro. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The sheriff of Union County, South Carolina, indicates the two young children of Susan Smith were drowned when the car they were in was submerged in a lake. Sheriff Howard Wells says it is accurate to conclude the children were alive when the car went into the local lake. Their bodies were recovered last night, 9 days after their mother told police they had been kidnapped when their car was stolen by a black man. Reporter Kathy Merritt of member station WMFE says the mood in the small town the family is from is frustrated and angry.
The mood here in Union, South Carolina is an angry one. People here don't understand why Susan Smith allegedly murdered her two young sons. Now that they know what happened, they want to know why it happened. That's really the question today. Why did Susan Smith do this? How could Susan Smith do this? When you talk to people who have young children, especially, they can't understand how a mother could murder her two young sons. And then a lot of people here feel that they've been duped. I think they feel a little embarrassed that this story is dragged out for 9 days and that they've tried to support her. The town has come together. There are yellow ribbons on the courthouse and on car antennas. And now there's a tremendous feeling of disappointment and anger.
Funeral services for Alex and Michael Smith will be this Sunday afternoon at a Methodist church in Union. The U.S. magistrate in the case of Francisco Duran, the man charged with shooting at the White House last weekend, may order lawyers on both sides to avoid speaking to the press. Duran's lawyer requested a gag order today. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
Right to a fair trial, according to documents filed by his lawyer, Lee Kenney. Kenney provided a thick stack of press clippings and said some of them unfairly prejudiced Duran. Kenney argued a gag order is essential to protect Duran's rights. The prosecution countered, under the order Kenney has in mind, no one would even be able to correct errors made by reporters. Assistant U.S. Attorney Eric Dubilier wrote, "There is no evidence Duran's rights have been or might be compromised. He expressed confidence the ethical and disciplinary rules already in place are appropriate. Duran is being held without bond." This is John Greenberg in Washington.
The government reports the nation's jobless rate has fallen to a 4-year low. The Labor Department says the unemployment rate dropped 0.1% to 5.8%. The agency also reports fewer people than expected got new jobs. 194,000 new jobs were created in October. That's below the 250,000 that many analysts had predicted. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 35 points to 3,810. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. In Nigeria, a federal appeals court has granted bail to the country's leading opposition leader. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Nigerian businessman Masud Abiola has been granted bail after being detained for 5 months while facing treason charges. Justice Umaru Abdullahi made the ruling on an appeal filed by Abiola. Abiola, the undeclared winner of the country's annulled presidential elections in June of last year, was not in court. Abiola has been in detention since he defied Nigeria's military regime by announcing that he was president. He has complained of his treatment during his incarceration, where he was initially denied access to family members, attorneys, and medical attention. Nationwide labor strikes and unrest to protest military rule that followed Abiola's arrest were crushed by Nigeria's military ruler, General Sani Abacha. And Abacha has ignored previous lower court orders to free Abacha and drop criminal charges against him. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
A published report says that New York's Roman Catholic Archdiocese plans to build a new hospital for AIDS patients and other people with infectious diseases. The New York Daily News reports the facility will have 100 beds, as well as a large outpatient diagnostic and treatment center. An archdiocese official says plans for the hospital and approval by the New York State Health Department are expected to be completed in January. Investigators looking into the fatal crash of a commuter plane in Indiana want to know if there's a link between icing and the flight of a plane on autopilot. A pilot who flew the same type of plane as the one that crashed this week has told investigators his aircraft dipped to the right while he was flying on autopilot during a heavy rainstorm in Indiana Monday night. He discovered an ice buildup on the plane's wings after he landed. The commuter plane that crashed was flying in the same conditions and had also rolled right before it crashed, killing all 68 people aboard. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We open this archive edition of our show with a recent interview about city streets and city politics. These are the subjects Steve Lopez writes about in his popular column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Now Lopez has joined the ranks of newspaper columnists turned novelists. Fellow columnist and novelist Pete Hamill praised Lopez's first novel for its style, dark humor, and sense of tragedy. It's called Third in Indiana, and it's set in a neighborhood known as the Badlands, where the streets are owned by drug dealers. As the novel opens, Gabriel, a 14-year-old drug dealer, has run away from home, leaving his mother no clues to explain his disappearance. Now she spends her nights riding a bicycle, searching the streets for him. In this passage, Gabriel is standing in a shadow, watching his mother pedal toward him on a bicycle much too small for her large body.
Maybe he should have gotten her a bigger bicycle. It had been a birthday present 6 months ago. Get some exercise, he had told her. She had put on so much weight since his father walked out on them without a word or a warning. Get some exercise, some fresh air, whatever. Just get out of the house. A person could suffocate in there. It was filled with so much unspoken disappointment. But Gabriel never really expected her to ride the bike. She'd be too self-conscious, for one thing. And she'd wonder where he got the money. He didn't know her as well as he thought he did. Not only was she riding the bicycle, but she was riding it in the middle of the night, looking for him. Damn, Gabriel thought. She shouldn't be out here at this hour, not in this neighborhood. Gabriel was 14, a dark sliver of a boy with slow, sad eyes that could stay sad through a smile. He was going to be a lady killer, his mother had been telling him since before he knew what it meant, and she had said it again a week ago, the night before he ran away. His first thought was to run to her now. His second was to just run. His right foot made the decision, a slow, backward step on the toe of his sneaker, and then he wheeled and was gone, lost in the darkness beyond the L as a train rattled over Philadelphia rooftops, past the steamed windows of sleeping babies, and past corners owned and ruled by drug gangs. Ophelia Santoro of Diamond Street fought the bicycle to a stop at the intersection of Lehigh and Kensington, her chest rising with each breath. The cops and prosecutors had a name for this part of town, which took in areas of Kensington and North Philadelphia and was good for several shootings a night and a drug trade that rivaled the gross national product of a dozen small nations. They called it the Badlands. If her husband were still around, he'd be the one out here searching the Badlands. If her husband were still around, Gabriel wouldn't have run away. That was the way she looked at it. The world wasn't worth living in, Ophelia thought. If it was a place where Gabriel could be dead, and her husband could be alive. If that were the case, she'd have to find a way to get word to him. He had a right to know.
Steve Lopez, thanks for reading that. How were you first introduced to this part of the city?
Well, I got to Philadelphia about 10 years ago. I was born and raised in the San Francisco area, and I came to the Philadelphia Inquirer as a general assignment reporter. And one of my early assignments took me to that neighborhood.
What did you see there that surprised you?
I was immediately horrified, intrigued. I couldn't get enough of it. I was struck by the complete devastation. It looked to me like it was the end of the world. Houses are literally crumbling. Glass all over the streets. Graffiti on all of the buildings. Kids selling drugs openly and doing so in the shadows of these shut-down factories. And although I had seen poverty, I had seen You know, urban problems in San Jose, California, and in Oakland and in San Francisco, I had seen nothing that came close in any way to the depth of the devastation in the neighborhood.
What were the stories that kept bringing you back to that neighborhood?
I guess I was fascinated by the fact that in the middle of all of that, there are people just struggling to hold on. The people living in fear, people afraid to let their children out of the house because they might get hit by a stray bullet. People who can't remember the last time they made it through a night without hearing gunshots. And you hear these stories over and over and over again, and you realize that these are, in a way, urban heroes. These are people who, if they could get out, certainly would, but are trapped. You have situations like maybe somebody bought a house for $15,000 or $20,000 10 years ago, 12 years ago. Today, in some of these neighborhoods, that house is worth nothing. You couldn't give it away. And so they're stuck. They're stuck with gangs working on the corner. They're stuck with unemployment that gets to 50% and above. They're stuck with high schools where each year begins, say, with 500 freshmen and 100 seniors because kids just don't make it. They either get into the drug trade or they're cut down, you know, by bullets, one thing or another. And I think what fascinated me was that there were so many people there who were just struggling to survive, people for whom the future is just tomorrow. Nobody who's thinking about where they're going to go on vacation next year or what kind of a job, you know, maybe they should work toward and what college they're going to go to. People just struggling to hold on.
How much were you able to get to know some of the really young drug dealers, people like Gabriel on the book?
Well, it's difficult. It's difficult. One time I was on I went with police on a sweep of the neighborhood, and they made some arrests, and I got an opportunity to talk to a 16-year-old who they arrested. And I asked him what the situation was, and I spoke to him in a jail cell. He had been arrested for selling drugs, and I asked him how he got into it. And he said he had gotten in a couple years ago as a lookout. That's how you begin, and maybe you make $50 a day or maybe $100 a day. And he knew that it was wrong. He knew that he shouldn't be doing it, but other kids were doing it, and he lived on a block where just about everybody has a piece of the action, one way or another. He later got a job working, helping out a landscaper, and he was making some money, and he thought, and it was important in his household because his father had just had a heart attack, lost his job, there were no medical benefits. His mother was trying to take care of the rest of the kids. He felt that he had to be the breadwinner. And the landscaper laid him off, and he would sit in his house and look outside and hear her kids his own age making $150 a day. So he began to do it, and he got pretty good at it. There are kids who actually excel at being drug dealers. And he said, I said to him, how long do you think you're going to live doing this? And he said, oh, not long, maybe a couple years. And I said, and then what's going to happen? And he said, I'm going to be shot and killed, probably right here. And I said, well, why do you do it? And he said, what is my alternative? How is my family going to eat? What if my father needs medicine? And you hear these kinds of stories on a regular basis.
Why did you want to write a novel? You've been a columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer for about 8 years, is it?
It's 8 years, 9 years, yeah. I wanted to write a novel because growing up, I never read. I grew up in a house where my father drove a Wonder Bread truck. My mother took care of the kids and had dinner ready every night. And then we watched sitcoms for about 4 hours. And I was not exposed to books. Nobody in my family had been exposed to books. I went to school, became a sports writer, and then switched over and became a news reporter. And when I did that, I met people who knew about things that I had never heard of. People who had traveled the world and were talking about books and museums and music. And things that I was exposed to a world that I never knew existed. And I started to play catch-up in my late 20s and my early 30s. I began reading the classics, the books that you're supposed to read when you're in high school. I actually made it through high school and college literally without reading a single book. If there was an assignment, I would read the flap, and I would just kind of skate through and, you know, just kind of fake it. Fake it till you make it.
You must have been pretty good at faking it.
Well, you know, I had some writing skills, but I had no interest in writing a book. I didn't know, or in reading a book, I didn't know that books were ideas. And when I started to read, one of the books that I came across was To Kill a Mockingbird. And I read it at a time in my life when I had a true appreciation for literature. And when I read that, I thought, this has got to be one of the most humane and noble acts in the 20th century, the writing of this book. Not so much because of the way that it's written, but because of what it says and how it says it. And I knew then that I wanted to, even more than learn how to play the guitar, I wanted to see if I could write a novel someday. So it began with that. It began with, I guess, out of anger a little bit, a bit of anger about not having been exposed to books early on and feeling as if I missed so much. Well, not only am I going to read them, I'm going to write them. That was sort of the attitude that I took.
My guest is Steve Lopez. He's a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and author of the new novel, Third in Indiana. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with columnist and novelist Steve Lopez. You had a recent column in the Inquirer about parking in South Philadelphia. And South Philadelphia is where one of the characters in your novel is from.
Right.
Italian neighborhood. A lot of powerful people in Philadelphia politics come from that neighborhood. And describe the parking things that you tried for this column.
Well, I had, in Philadelphia... there is this history of certain people living by different rules than people in other neighborhoods. North Philadelphia in Philadelphia happens to be primarily black. South Philadelphia happens to be primarily white. And there is this history in the city that if you park in the middle of the street in South Philadelphia, we're talking about a four-lane thoroughfare, and down the middle of that is double yellow lines running parallel and wide enough that a car can fit in the middle. In South Philadelphia, you can park in the middle of the street. It's okay. Technically, it's against the law, but it's not enforced. And I was aware of that, of course, and was aware as well that in North Philadelphia, there are no cars in the middle of the street. So I had wanted to do this for quite a while, to take my car up to North Philadelphia and just park it in the middle of the street and see what happened. See how long it took to get a ticket or to get towed or whatever. So I drove up there one day, and I parked, and I got out, and I stood on the sidewalk, and I walked up the block, and I don't think I made it back down to the other side, and I saw somebody writing a ticket for it. And it was 7 minutes. In 7 minutes, I got a ticket. All right, got in the car, drove to South Philadelphia, parked in the middle of the street, and I waited 7 minutes. I waited a half hour, and I decided to celebrate that I would go into a little restaurant there, had a meatball sandwich to celebrate that, you know, we were up to an hour now. came out of the restaurant. The car is still there, no ticket. And so I took the subway and went home. And the next morning I checked on it, and the next night, and for 15 days went to see if they would give me a ticket or if it would have gotten towed or anything. And it was untouched.
My favorite part of that column, like many people in Philadelphia, I have a favorite restaurant in South Philadelphia. It's a little hard to park there because on every block there's at least one or two spaces that are cordoned off for disabled parking. And I've always thought, like, how many handicapped people can there possibly be living in this three-block radius?
That is another scam in Philadelphia. You get those through your ward leader. And, you know, we have that system here, the old machine.
So it's a way of just reserving a spot for yourself.
There you go. Yeah.
You have a column about city commissioner in Philadelphia, Marge Tartaglione, who handles elections.
Right.
And this was after, you wrote this after an article came out in the Philadelphia Inquirer about how the city is spending more for parts and maintenance of its voting machines than nearly any other city.
Right.
So what you did was you transcribed word for word what she had to say in an interview that was recorded by a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Right.
And, gee, maybe I can get you to read some of that?
Okay, this is from a two-hour interview that an Inquirer reporter did, and he asked her a question. He was asking her about why do you need so many mechanics to fix these things? Why are they paid such overtime, and why do the parts cost so much? And Marge said, it's like my husband. He used to have a gas station, all right? When they were a car came, a new car, they'd lift up the hood. Everything was metric tools. Now, it cost them a fortune to go out to buy the metric tools. Somebody says, oh, come on, you could use these. He says, yeah, and strip the bearings or strip whatever it is. Now, these voting machines are antiquated. They're antiquated. Now, how old is this machine? All right, 45. If you were a mechanic 45 years ago, the younger generation, everything has changed. You take the new machines, you take the computers, and it's getting harder and harder. Like, it's getting harder and harder to get parts. Or to complete a sentence was what I wrote at the end of that paragraph.
Now, is that cruel?
Is it cruel?
Yeah. To transcribe that and just mock her for...
I think what's cruel is that we have a public official who can't answer a simple question and who presides over a system that was the subject of a state investigation. An election was overturned. We have these things going on, and she and the others involved have done very little to reform it or to change the fact that it's just a patronage house. It's a way for them to hire employees. And she does not think or speak like I think a responsible public official should. And I think this paragraph is an example of her, you know, being evasive. She's not going to answer the question. And I think I don't think it's cruel. I think it's important to just call her on it, to say, look, where's the answer? You're rambling on. This doesn't make a lot of sense. What's the point?
You once took her to a shopping mall and did a column on that. What was that about?
Well, I was at the Democratic National Convention in Atlanta. I guess it was 1988. And I was following around the Pennsylvania delegates. And she, I don't remember if she was a delegate or an alternate, but she and a few other public officials, including two who prior to that time had gone to Las Vegas for a National League of Cities convention and were followed by a reporter who reported that they spent most of the time playing nickel slots in a casino and missing all of these workshops and symposiums. So here are the three of them in the bar when workshops and meetings are going on at the Democratic National Convention. And I looked at them and I said, what are you doing? And they said something like, well, you know, the meetings are kind of boring. And I thought to myself, well, what story can I get here? I said, shopping. They'd probably like to go shopping. And I had passed a shopping mall. And I said, what do you say? If I can get a car, you want to go to the shopping mall? And, you know, they jumped up off the bar stools. And I went and called the office, and I said, is it okay if I rent a limo to take, you know, the Boom Boom Sisters and Marge Tartaglione to a shopping mall? And they said, sure, go ahead. So I took them to the mall, and the point of it was that here
yes.
they should have been, you know, representing the city, attending the workshops, whether they were alternates or not. And they were, you know, lounging around the lobby and drinking and, you know, perfectly happy and willing to get in a limo and go shopping.
Gee, isn't that a little bit like, what's the word when a cop propositions a prostitute?
Entrapment.
Entrapment, thank you.
Well, shopping mall, that was definite entrapment on my part. I knew that the words shopping mall would get them. And I don't know. I mean, it's... I don't think that I handled it in a cruel way. I handled it in a light-hearted, sort of tongue-in-cheek way. And they knew what was going on. I mean, they participated.
So what did they think of your column?
Well, I don't remember whether they responded. I think one of them said, well, you gave us a few knocks, but it was kind of fun. It's a city, believe me, it's a city without shame.
One other column I have to ask you about. You went to a barber to get a mob hairdo. How did you find the barber, and what was the inspiration for this column?
Well, when I first got to Philadelphia, that's another thing I was fascinated with, was the mafia and how it flourished and how, you know, everybody seemed to know, hey, you see that guy walking down the street? That's a mobster. And I forget whether the haircut was before or after I got thrown out of a mafia party celebrating a murder acquittal. I went to the Four Seasons and was literally thrown out of the party. But I got... The reason for the haircut story was I was looking through the paper one day, and it was a day when about 15 mobsters were rounded up, indicted, arrested, whatever. And we had mugshots in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and I noticed that everybody in the mugshot had the same haircut. And so I called an attorney, a Philadelphia attorney, who represents a lot of them. And I said, Bobby, Steve Lopez of the Inquirer, working on a story here on the mafia. He said, what angle are you working on? And I said, the haircuts. I want to know where they get their haircuts. And he said to me, I had not talked to him before that, and he said to me, words I'll never forget, would you come out of a tree or what? And I, when I do interviews on the phone, I'm typing there on the other end, and I can't type that fast. Let me tell you, so I said, I wasn't even sure what he said, so I said, excuse me, could you repeat that? Would you come out of a tree or what? And I said, okay, out of a tree or what? Well, thank you. The thing is, Bobby, do you know where I can get a haircut like that? And he said, what are you, stupid? And I said, you know, I've just been all my life a step or two behind the fashion trends. And I thought if I get the haircut that everybody else in town has, you know, maybe it'll change my life. And he started to laugh at that. And he said, all right, here's where you go. And he told me what barbershop to go to. So I went down there and they said, what do you want? And I said, I want the mob do. And that was all I needed to say. He got out the scissors and started cutting.
Now, did the mob do look like a hairpiece, but it was the real thing?
Well, the thing is, short, brushed back. See, back, I had more hair at the time, and it worked a little better. Right now, I'm not sure that a mob do would look very good on me. But it's...
You might need a little bit of the hairpiece up front, is that what you're saying?
That's right, that's right. And it's just a short brush cut, and it's all combed straight back. Yeah, it looks very sharp, very sharp.
Now, I believe you have a second novel in the works that's going to be about what you describe as hack Philadelphia politicians. There's obviously something about a certain kind of politician in Philadelphia that really interests you, and I'd like to see if you could describe what it is.
Well, I guess it's the last of the machine politicians that I'm intrigued by. At first, you find it, the whole thing repulsive, that they play by this whole different set of rules, that it's okay to break the law if a constituent benefits. It's okay to put somebody on a ghost payroll if it's really a good kid. You know, it's okay to lie on an application and get somebody a college loan if in the end, well, he's going to benefit. Maybe he comes back and the neighborhood benefits. There is that school in Philadelphia. And as I said, when you first come here and you look at it, you think, my God, these are dinosaurs. You know, it's like Boss Tweed kind of stuff. When you get to know them, some of them, you find that there's some charm that goes with it. They maybe have some chromosomes bent or something. I mean, they don't quite think right, but they have a great deal of charm, and they really believe that that's the system that works. The system that works best is where instead of calling the streets department to fix your street, you call the guy on the corner who happens to be a committee man, who knows the ward leader, who can call this guy in Harrisburg, the state capital, and get this thing done like that. And along that route, everybody's getting some kind of a kickback. Everybody's got a piece of the action. And it sort of keeps them in business. And I'm fascinated by that. And so it's almost gone in American cities. And I want to write this novel is, in a way, I guess, a denouncement and a tribute. It's sort of a goodbye to those old-time machine politicians.
Steve Lopez, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Steve Lopez is a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. His new novel is called Third in Indiana. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, inventing the sound that became known as surf guitar, we feature a 1993 interview with Dick Dale. He's influenced several generations of guitar players, and Leo Fender had to build a special amp to withstand the volume that Dale pushed through it. Dale's loud, fast, reverberating staccato sets the tone for Quentin Tarantino's film Pulp Fiction. Tarantino uses Dale's recording of Miserloo for the opening credit sequence. Also, Stephen Schiff reviews the new film from Kenneth Branagh, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, starring Branagh and Robert De Niro. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A reported letter may shed light on the killing of two South Carolina boys. Susan Smith is now charged with murdering her sons, ages 3 and 1. She had claimed they were abducted in a carjacking, but investigators say she confessed to killing them yesterday. A report says the note was from Smith's boyfriend, who said he didn't want any kids around. The Clinton administration says that the good news in today's economic report means that Democratic policies are working. Labor Secretary Robert Reich has hailed the decrease in the unemployment rate. UPI's Bill Small has this report.
The president led his administration's cheers for the latest drop in the unemployment rate, telling reporters in Minnesota it's a clear sign of economic progress, a sentiment echoed here by Labor Secretary Robert Reich.
Overall unemployment is down to 5.8%. In October, that's from 5.9% in September, 6.1% in August, 6.7% last January. The unemployment rate is at its lowest level right now since October of 1990.
Reich acknowledges that some Americans may not be feeling the economic improvement yet, but he says they soon will. Bill Small at the White House.
Republican challengers in next week's House elections are spending almost twice as much as they were 2 years ago. Figures released today by the Federal Election Commission show that Democratic incumbents haven't come close to matching the GOP increase, but the Democratic incumbents still have a 2-to-1 financial edge. NPR's Peter Overby has more.
The party out of power usually has a harder time financially. That's still true this year. Although Republicans hope to take control of the Senate and pick up 20 or more House seats, their challengers went into the campaign's final 3 weeks with just $6 million on hand. That's compared to $43 million for Democratic incumbents. Although the GOP's individual candidates are behind, the party's national committees are thriving. The GOP's national committees are outraising the Democratic committees almost 2-to-1. And as the election approaches, the Republican committees have nearly $8 million in the bank, while the Democrats are slightly in debt. This is Peter Overby in Washington.
The man who's charged with shooting at the White House wants a gag order on his case. Francisco Duran's lawyer says her client might not get a fair trial because of all the publicity surrounding the incident. Lee Kenney has asked U.S. Magistrate Deborah Robinson to stop government officials from discussing the case. Kenney cited several news reports about the incident. She pointed to reports that say, quote, sources close to the investigation. Kenney says other reports are just wrong. Robinson has not yet ruled on the request. On Wall Street, stock prices were lower today. The Dow lost more than 38 points to end at 3,807. Declines led advances by a margin of more than 2-to-1. This is NPR. NASA reports that a key mission has been completed aboard the space shuttle Atlantis. The French astronaut aboard the shuttle has released a German satellite containing a telescope. It will conduct atmospheric research for the next 8 days. It will orbit away from Atlantis to avoid contamination from shuttle exhaust during its observations. Instruments aboard the $35 million satellite will create a three-dimensional map of the flow of gases in Earth's middle atmosphere. The mayor of Paris has become the first candidate to announce he's running for president of France. His main opponent in next year's elections is expected to be the prime minister. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Paris Mayor Jacques Chirac was expected to run, but the timing of his declaration came as a surprise. The other leading contenders say they won't make any announcement until January. However, Chirac said he wanted to clarify the political debate in France, where an unofficial campaign has been underway for weeks. Chirac, who's head of the right-wing RPR party, is expected to be competing against conservative Prime Minister Edouard Balladur. The two men are longtime friends, but recently they've started to criticize each other in the press. And their supporters, including cabinet ministers, have started arguing as well. The infighting is expected to get worse as the spring election draws near. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Reuters News Service is quoting a defense official who says Saudi Arabia has rejected the United States' request to base military weapons in that country. Washington is expected to press the Saudis to change their minds. The U.S. has asked several Persian Gulf countries to store U.S. weapons and equipment in their countries in case American troops are quickly summoned to the region again. The official also told Reuters Kuwait will pay the largest share of the estimated $600 million cost of the recent U.S. military buildup. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Quentin Tarantino has found something in surf music that I certainly never heard until I saw Tarantino's new film, Pulp Fiction. He says surf music sounds to him like rock and roll spaghetti western music, rock and roll Ennio Morricone. Tarantino uses a couple of surf records as part of his film score. Bullwinkle Part 2 by the Centurions plays during the John Travolta heroin montage. And Dick Dale's Miserloo is the opening credit music. Tarantino says he never understood the connection between surfing and surf music. Coming up, we'll get an explanation from the king of surf guitar himself, Dick Dale. First, let's hear Dale's recording of Miserloo and Tarantino's explanation of why he chose it for the credit sequence. These comments are from a Pulp Fiction promotional CD.
To me, the opening credits are very, very important because that's sort of like your... That's like the only like mood time that most movies give themselves, you know, and like, you know, a cool credit sequence and the like with that and the music that plays in front of it, you know, or no play any music in front of it, you know, whatever you decide to do, that sets up like a tone for the movie that is important for you, and so that's, you know, so I'm always trying to find like what the right opening credit or closing credit sequence should be, you know, early on when I'm just even thinking about the story. Because once I find it, that really kind of triggers me in to what the personality of this piece should be, what the rhythm of this piece should be. Like I'm saying, you don't have to use music. It could just be silence, all right? All right, and but then that's important. That is like kind of in some ways like the rhythm and more or less the personality you're trying to project in this film. Having Miserloo as your opening credits, it's just so intense, you know. It just says, you're watching an epic, you're watching this big old movie, just sit back, because, you know, I mean, because it's so loud and blaring at you, you know. It's just like, actually, it throws down a gauntlet that the movie now has to live up to, because it's just saying, we're big.
That's Dick Dale on guitar. Dick Dale was one of the originators of the surf music sound, and his band, the Deltones, was the focus of the music scene that grew up around the California surf culture of the late 50s and early 60s. Dale played in the films Beach Party and Muscle Beach Party and the campy sequel Back to the Beach. He doesn't surf anymore. In fact, he doesn't even live near the beach. He lives in the desert. I spoke to him about surf guitar in July 1993.
Music to me is like a facet in my life. I love many things. I've trained lions and tigers, raised them for 30 years, and been in the martial arts for 30 years, been flying airplanes, and just doing so many things that are very interesting, and music was just one of them. And I was raised actually listening to the big band era, you know, like Guy Lombardo, Harry James, and the first person that I really listened to was Gene Krupa on drums. And that's where I get this heavy staccato drumming effect on playing. Like Mick Fleetwood of Fleetwood Mac once said to me, watching me, he said, my God, he says, you're the most percussive guitarist I've ever seen in my life. You look like you're playing drums. And I do. I'm playing all the different parts of the drums when I play my guitar. So actually, drums was my first, and Gene Krupa was my first big influence.
Some of the surf music stars didn't really surf, most notably the Beach Boys. But you did. You actually did surf. Is there a connection between the sounds that you'd hear surfing and the kind of music you were playing?
Yes. The sounds were actually compared to actually my lions and tigers and the ocean, the power of my tigers and the power of the ocean. When I would get, you know, thrown across a cage, you know, with one blow, or seeing the cat go with 2,200 pounds per square inch bite through a stainless steel pan, and you just marvel at man cannot control that, and then you get out in a wave, and then you get out and you stop paddling, and you're facing a 6-footer or an 8-footer, and let alone a 10-footer. It is the most frightening thing in the world, and you just have to just dig down and go for it. And then when you get sucked up and taken over, you never feel strength like that in your life, and you just can't stop that power, so you must ride with it. And that's when I learned to really go with the flow of everything in life, and the waves did create my feelings of that sound, that ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka. It was like the lip of a wave coming over the top of my head. I'd stick my finger in the wall and get my ear up as close as I could, getting in a tube, or then doing a bottom turn and missing it and getting sucked up over the top and being just crunched right through your board. And in those days, we used the big 10-footers, you know.
Did the sound of the ocean make you want to get that loud, amplified sound that you wanted?
Yeah, it's a combination of the ocean and the roar of my tigers and lions, and just putting it all together, that force. And the ocean just has the two sounds. It has the one that comes over the top of your head. It's a lacy sound, and then it has that bottom rumbling sound, and then it has that wipeout sound. And with my big 60-gauge strings, like most guitar players are using 7s and 8s and 9s, the slinkies, you know, and 10s, my thinnest string is a 14 unwound. And then I use two 18 unwounds for my second and third string, and then my fourth string I use a 38 wound, and my fifth I use a 48, and then I use a 58 or a 60, whichever ones I can get.
So this is like really thick strings you're using, and that gives it a deeper sound?
Yeah, it gives it a big, Joel Sullivan calls them bridge cables. It gives you a real, real fat, thick sound, along with the combination of what goes into this amplifier and the guitar and the speaker. It's a combination of everything. But playing them is very hard. It's very painful because it's like taking your finger and going up and down, you know, the sidewalk with it. And that's why when I make faces, everybody goes, "Oh man, you make the neatest faces." I go, "That's pain. That's not."
No. What about the picking style that you developed?
The picking came from my father's side of the family. His mother and father were born in Beirut, Lebanon, and my mother's side of the family were born in Poland. So I was subject to the musical styles of both countries. But when I had that influence of that Arabic music, when I came to California, a kid asked me, he said, "Can you play on one string?" Because I was playing what I called rockabilly. And I developed a rock-a-tuck style of strumming on the guitar because I didn't have a whole band. So I would go, tink-a-ta, 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 tink-a-ta. So now, when I did that, this little boy, he was probably about 10, and at my first show at the Rendezvous Ballroom in Balboa, that's when it opened up. We had like 17 surfers and the kids I was surfing with. And he says, "Can you play on one string?" And I didn't know what to do. And I says, "Well, come back tomorrow night, and I'll have something for you," just to get rid of them. And then when I went home, I says, "Oh, my God, I'm going to get caught. I'm going to be found out that I'm a fake, you know, that I can't play on one string or something." And I thought, and I says, "Mizzaloo." And Mizzaloo was played very slowly. I went and quadrupled the sound. I went tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick because I wanted a machine gun staccato picking style, which is very difficult to play because you have to keep your meter properly. And then as a result, you break stainless steel strings and you melt picks down, two or three of them in a song, they melt. And that's why I have a special pick holder that I reach down and I throw one out when I play and I pick one up and I continue melting. But that's how I get that sound. It's like a machine gun picking style.
Well, let's hear your original recording of Miserlou, which you made back in 1962.
Yeah, I think the original people that did it was are probably turning over in their grave when they heard it the way I play it.
Dick Dale has reissued on Rhino Records, and Dick Dale also has a new album out. What was the scene like on the beach when you started surfing and playing?
We would go down to the beach at 5 o'clock in the morning to get the early glass off and build a fire to keep warm. We never had wetsuits at that time, so we froze in the water. Our legs would turn blue. We'd beat on our legs to stop the pain, and we just hoped that the next wave, waiting for the next wave, and you just beat on our thighs, just to keep the pain from going away. It was just that everybody had a camaraderie about them, and basically in California, everyone that went to a Dick Dale dance, we all met at the beach, and we would all surf, and we'd just surf all day, come out of the water, break, and have a sandwich, and go back in and surf to the evening glass-offs.
My guest is Dick Dale, the king of the surf guitar. We're after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring a 1993 interview with Dick Dale. His recording Miserlou is used in the new film Pulp Fiction. When you started playing, you wanted a really loud sound, and you couldn't get it loud enough. And you knew Leo Fender, the guitar maker, and what you worked together to get an amplifier that would give you the volume you wanted?
Well, what happened was it wasn't as much as volume. What it was a quality of sound. I wanted to get a fat, thick, deep sound that was very fat, sounding like a big floor tom, a tom-tom, because once again, listening to the Gene Krupa drumming, and when we never mic'd our amplifiers, we never had mics in front of amplifiers, so the amplifier had to sound thick and pure on its own merit, and with Leo making just amplifiers that are only 10-inch speakers, you cannot get a sound out of a 10-inch speaker that gives you a fat, thick sound. So when Leo Fender would call me to come to his factory, he said, "Dick, I've got it. I've got this the sound." I'd go up there and I'd play this amplifier that he'd have, and it would be really loud, and really powerful. And I go, "Wow, that's sounds great." But then when I took it to the Rendezvous Ballroom and got it on the stage, and there's 4,000 people out there, all of a sudden their clothes would suck up the sound and suck up the thickness and the bassness of this sound, and I wouldn't have any more power or any more depth of sound. So I kept trying to tell Leo that, and we kept on making all these adjustments with output transformers, with speakers, and that's how I blew up over 48 speakers and amplifiers. They'd catch on fire. The speakers would freeze. The speakers would tear from the coils. We went to Lansing Company and said, "Listen, we need a beefier speaker that'll handle the big bass strings, that'll handle this output transformer." And then Leo finally came to, and Freddie Travers came to the Rendezvous, stood in the middle of 4,000 people to watch what I was doing, and they looked at each other and they said, "Now I know what Dick's trying to tell me." So he went back to the drawing board, came up and invented the Dick Dale Showman amplifier and the dual Showman amplifier with the 15-inch Lansing speaker. That was the end result of the sound, and along with the creations that we did on the Stratocaster guitar, making it a real thick body, because the thicker the wood, the more pure the sound.
Right. Let me play one of your early records. This dates back to 1962. It's surf beat. You want to say something about the record? And, you know, right before we started the interview, you told me you hate your early records. Do you hate this record?
Well, I don't hate the song. No, I don't hate the song. I hate the way it was recorded because it just wasn't big and fat like I play. And no one's ever been able to capture that. In high tone, this is the first time in my life that I ever consented to coming in, like 30 years of recording. You know, I come back from 30 years or something, and they said, Dick, do what you want. And this is the first time in my life I ever had an engineer wanting to please and say, hey, don't worry about the time being spent, like High Tone said. Don't worry about it. We're going to put everything into how long it takes to get you happy, to get that sound. And the end result was no fancy overdubbing. Ry Cooter was asked by Scotty. He said, how do I record Dick Dale? And Ry Cooter said, don't infect Dick Dale's brain with anything going on today because he don't know what's going on today. He's up in the mountain someplace and he could care less. Just plug him in, turn the tape recorder on, and let him go, and don't let the needles go into the red, and just record it. And that's exactly what we did. And it was nothing but just creativity right from beginning to end.
So you don't like the way you were recorded on the early records?
No, it did not have, it sounded too tinny, and I was too ashamed to play them to anybody.
You were ashamed to play your own records?
I never played my own records. I never even kept them in the house.
Hmm.
Because I listened to Hank Williams instead.
Well, okay, so I'm going to play it.
Does that sound strange?
Well, yeah. But I'll be the one to play it. I'll play your 1962 recording of Surf Beat. That's Dick Dale recorded in 1962. It's interesting. I mean, here you are like Mr. Surf Guitar and everything. You're living in the desert. Pretty paradoxical. What's it like for you to live so far from the ocean?
Well, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And the thing lies is I almost get squished away from the ocean because the population is just, it's just like somebody built a shoebox and put a bunch of mice in it, and the mice kept growing and growing, and the shoebox stays the same. So it's so sad that the population is just exploding, and everyone's running around with their heads chopped off or something. So I wanted peace. So I went up to the high desert, and if I don't speak, I can hear my ears ring. And it's so wonderful up there. It's like living in a tomb. And it just gives you another 20 years to your life because it's so beautiful with the desert creatures. And it's a place to raise my 17-month-old son. And it's just peaceful, so peaceful.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I can't wait to get back and out there and do the whole thing.
Dick Dale recorded last year. His latest record is called Unknown Territory. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Martha Raddatz reports tonight on what is now a murder case in South Carolina. Instead of a kidnapping, the mother of two children in Union, South Carolina, according to police, has confessed to killing her two young boys. Ina Jaffe reports on the voter profile in California. Elizabeth Arnold on the campaigns in the western states. David Barron has the story of a proposal for new regulations aimed at preventing repetitive stress injury in the workplace. And Bob Mondello takes us back through the Frankenstein on film versions in light of the new Kenneth Branagh, Helena Bonham Carter, Robert De Niro version coming to the theaters.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Before 1988, Kenneth Branagh was known to American audiences as a pleasant, nondescript British actor who showed up now and then in pleasant, nondescript British films. But then he directed and starred in his version of Shakespeare's Henry V, and suddenly he was an international star. Since then, he's directed another Shakespeare film, Much Ado About Nothing, as well as Dead Again and Peter's Friends. And now he's tackled one of the great horror classics. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Even Kenneth Branagh's Shakespeare movies, which I've liked a lot, have a certain problem that his other movies, which I don't like at all, suffer from. Too much energy. I'm not talking about real energy, the kind that actors and directors earn through intensity and close observation. I'm talking about the way, in Much Ado About Nothing, for instance, everybody was always frantically dancing and singing and grinning from ear to ear. I'm talking about the way the camera whirled and careened for no good reason throughout Dead Again. And I'm talking about almost every scene in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. As young Victor Frankenstein, the mad scientist-to-be, Branagh himself storms through the streets of small German towns like a crusading young lawyer seeking justice. Whenever the camera catches sight of Helena Bonham Carter as his fiancée, it starts swooning and spinning deliriously. If someone arrives at the Frankenstein mansion, he can't be met by, say, a nice hunchback named Igor. No, the entire happy household has to come scampering out to greet him while the music soars. Most of the scenes in this movie are either overcome by the jitters or swollen with grandiose speechifying, and some of them combine the two. Take this scene, for instance, in which Branagh's Frankenstein is bickering with his medical school buddy Henry, played by Tom Hulce. Frankenstein has gotten hold of the journals of the late Dr. Waldman, who shortly before his death came very near to recreating life in the lab.
I've got the raw materials. I've got Waldman's journals. Together we know more than Krebs' whole staff.
You stole Waldman's journals.
We owe it to him to complete this work. He was one step away.
He never wanted this.
He couldn't face it. There's a difference.
Even if it were possible, and even if you had the right, which you don't, to make this decision for us, can you imagine for one second that there wouldn't be a terrible price to pay?
I think for the chance to defeat death and disease, to let everyone on this earth have the chance of life, sustained, healthy life, to allow people who love each other to be together forever. For all of that, I think it's a risk worth taking.
Well, you know the rest of the story. Frankenstein makes his monster, and it's one of the movie's best scenes, one of the only places in which Branagh's hysterical, gooey style seems appropriate to what he's showing us. But the rest of the film feels strangely hollow. The monster is played by Robert De Niro, and he really is a sight to see, with skin like the skin of a baked potato and stitches everywhere. Since Frankenstein has given him the late Dr. Waldman's brain, the monster can read scientific literature and carry on intelligent discourse. But Branagh never gets anywhere near the kind of filmmaking conviction that would make this stuff plausible. I don't mind that the movie isn't scary. I do wish that Branagh had made his Dr. Frankenstein an intriguingly haunted soul instead of this beaming, ruddy schoolboy who just wants to make the world a nicer place to live. Kenneth Branagh's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein has plenty of blood and guts and goo. What it doesn't have and badly needs is real darkness.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who did double duty today directing the show. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, Richard Parker, and Bob Balls. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.